The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I'm here with Misha Angrist, assistant professor at the Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. Misha was one of the first 10 people to have their genomics sequenced as part of Harvard's Personal Genome Project. He's the author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. Welcome, Misha.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you were the fourth subject in the Personal Genome Project, so tell us a bit about the PGP.
The PGP really came to my attention in 2006. There was a cover story in Scientific American called Genomes for All by George Church, a geneticist at Harvard. And here was a guy who, less than 3 years after the completion of the Human Genome Project, was saying, you know, it's time to think about doing this on a much larger scale, with many more people, and figuring out what we're going to do with all of that information. And as I read, I sort of felt like here was a guy who was articulating some things that I had felt for many years, but couldn't quite crystallize them the way he could.
Now, just to clarify for people, we are talking about sequencing the entire genome, not just the few million markers that the direct-to-consumer personal genomics companies look at, correct?
That is correct. So we talk about the variome, V-A-R-I-O-M-E. That is what you get if you, say, sign up for 23andMe or Navigenics or one of these companies where you spit in a tube and you send them your saliva and they extract your DNA from it and they look at a million or so places scattered across your 3 billion base pair genome, and they look at those million or so places where your genome varies and they look at what those variants are and what traits are associated with them. So that's probably the sort of crudest whole genome technique that we have. There is also a lot of exome sequencing. So that's about 30 million base pairs, or if we look at both sets of chromosomes from mom and from dad, that's about 60 million. And so the exome refers to the actual genes. So most of our DNA, we really don't actually know what it does. And somewhere between 1 and 2% codes for protein. And so those protein-coding genes, we are better positioned to understand what variation in those stretches of DNA means, although that is far from a perfect science. So that is apt to cost $1,000, something like that, versus you can do 23andMe for $99 plus a subscription.
Right.
And then the whole genome is ideally all 3 billion. But if you ask George Church, he will say we still don't have a complete human genome. We have about 93% of it because, you know, there's a small bit that is so repetitive, it doesn't want to be sequenced. So that's what I had done in 2009 and again about a year ago. And the cost of that has fallen to less than $10,000.
In just that amount of time.
So Craig Venter's genome, his was the first diploid, that is both copies, where both copies of the chromosome were sequenced, of the 23 pairs of chromosomes, and his was the first identifiable genome, and his was the first genome made public in 2007. And his genome took actually many years and about $70 million. something like that using the first generation DNA sequencing technology. Jim Watson's genome was sequenced around the same time, a little later, and probably cost $2 million using what we call next generation sequencing technology.
There's a rather large gap between, you know, full sequencing technology and companies like 23andMe. So what kinds of things do they actually offer?
Well, I think that depends on who you ask. Some of my clinical geneticist friends would say they offer snake oil.
Right.
I would disagree with that characterization. But, you know, neither would I argue that they have revolutionized healthcare in any way. I think what they offer is information. They offer a glimpse into one's own DNA, what variants one carries. That may be carrier status for rare diseases. You can learn something about drug response, and you can learn something about what traits have been associated with various markers across the genome. Now, the sort of rude awakening that genetics had over the last few years was that common diseases like type 2 diabetes and Crohn's disease tend to be caused by many genes of small effect, plus or minus the environment, usually plus. And so it becomes a computationally very challenging problem to use that information to make predictions about whether someone will develop type 2 diabetes or Crohn's disease or heart disease. It's not to say that we can't use that information to make existing predictions a little better, but what has been revealed over the last few years is that the genome is not a crystal ball, and only people who inherit rare diseases that are caused by, say, one or at most a few powerful genes, those are the people who we can make predictions about. And that's sort of been the province of clinical genetics and probably will remain so. Although, again, as the technology has gotten so cheap, we're finding it hard to keep the toothpaste in the tube.
As it were.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I'm wondering about. One of the problems with new technologies like this, especially when they're this complex, is that the government and regulators don't really know what to do with the companies that are producing things like this, and particularly when they're offering services to the public. They didn't really even know how to classify these kinds of companies when they first entered the market, correct?
Yeah, and I would argue that they still don't. There has been what I would consider to be a protracted comedy of errors since the initial direct-to-consumer companies launched in 2007, and actually even prior to that, in 2006, the U.S. Congress held hearings criticizing several so-called nutrigenomics companies, which claim to look at your genetic variation and at, say, just a few genes, because this was 2006, and then tell you what sort of diet you should eat. And unfortunately, in the case of at least a couple of those companies, sell you supplements at greatly inflated prices. So, you know, there was a big hullabaloo, as there was in the summer of 2010. There were hearings that did not reflect well on companies like 23andMe and Navigenics. But the fact is, the FDA, in my opinion, still really doesn't know what box to put these companies in. You could argue that the companies, in their disclaimers, they say, look, we're not practicing medicine, we're not diagnosing disease. you know, they do that to legally cover their behinds. And this is what bothers physicians, or many of them. They see these companies as practicing medicine without a license. And the two main criticisms of these companies and of personal genomics in general are, one, the information is useless, and two, the information is harmful. In my opinion, I'm prepared to entertain the first criticism. I'm really not prepared to entertain the second one. I think if people want this information, then it's theirs. It's from their cells.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Misha Angrist, assistant professor at the Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, and author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. I'm still curious. When places like 23andMe, so you spit in a cup, you send it off to be analyzed, and you get it back. So what do you get back exactly?
They'll send you an email. They'll say your results are ready, and you go and you log on to a secure website, and you will come to sort of a dashboard, and it will direct you to various kinds of results. Some of those I've mentioned already: disease risk, carrier status.
What they're giving you is your risk level. So what does that mean? Is it a comparison?
So what they've done is, you know, at any given site in the genome, you can have, so the four letters of the DNA alphabet are A, T, G, and C. And at any given site, you are either heterozygous or homozygous. That is, you have two of the same letter because you inherited, say, an A from each parent, or you have one of one letter and one of another letter because you inherited different letters from each parent. And those, what we call genotypes, have been associated in case control studies with disease risk or with response to certain medications. And that's what those companies are telling you. So they may say, you are heterozygous at one of the CYP2D genes that controls the way you metabolize drugs. And so therefore, if you ever need to go on a blood thinner, you should tell your doctor, this is my genotype. So that's one of the rare examples where you can actually sort of connect the dots between getting the information and having it make a difference in your healthcare. And so, for example, in my book, it so happens that my nephew had a rare form of deep vein thrombosis and needed to get on a blood thinner. And I happened to be in the hospital room as I watched his doctor very painstakingly talk to my nephew about warfarin, the most commonly prescribed blood thinner, which is actually rat poison. And so the dosing is very tricky because, you know, if you don't give someone enough, then you've not thinned their blood and they're susceptible to clotting and that sort of thing. If you give them too much, then you kill them. And so using genetics to get a better understanding of dosing is something that the medical community is, I would say, still somewhat divided over. But I think people generally agree that if you already have someone's genotype, you can use that to guide dosing.
That's one of the things that I don't think that the public really understands about this. Just because you have a marker or two that's common to a disease, that doesn't mean that you're going to get the disease necessarily, because right, the markers are only one part of the puzzle.
Exactly. And so the companies have been criticized, and I think rightly so, for giving people discrepant answers. Having one company tell you have an elevated risk of heart attack and another company telling you have a decreased risk of heart attack, and maybe a third telling you have an average risk. Why does that happen? Well, a couple of reasons. One is the companies use different markers, and chances are they're not catching all of the markers that contribute to the trait. So you have this, you know, Venn diagram where the overlap is possibly not that great between the different markers that the different companies are using. And the other problem is there's really no industry standard as to interpreting what those markers mean. And initially, there was some talk that the companies would put their heads together and they would develop such a standard. They have not, because they view one another as competitors and they don't want to share their algorithms. Let's say we're looking at two markers for susceptibility to macular degeneration, a late onset eye disease. And one company says, well, we get our risk simply by multiplying the individual risk of those two markers. And the other company says, well, that's fine, but we multiply and subtract 3 or something like that. They view those sorts of things as proprietary. So we don't know. It's a black box to us.
We have an audience question. This is from Bytor.
How do these 23andMe type tests compare to the tests where you can find out about your ethnic background and place in the prehistorical out of Africa gene lines?
So this is a whole other segment of the personal genomics industry, which is ancestry. So for people who watched Henry Louis Gates' most recent series on public television, Faces of America, he actually genotyped various celebrities and scholars and friends of his to use DNA to identify their genetic ancestry. How well can we do that? The answer is it depends. If you are a person of European descent, it tends to work pretty well because we have a lot of genotype information on Europeans. So we can get a decent idea of where someone is from. So, for example, when I go on 23andMe and look on the ancestry part of the website, I see that my paternal line goes back to most likely somewhere in the Ukraine. And it so happens that that lines up with what I know about my family history fairly well. Does that mean that that's not a coincidence? You know, we can't be sure, but it's probably in the ballpark. Now, for somebody of, say, mixed race ancestry, or somebody with Native American ancestry, where the databases are not as well populated, and we don't have this collection of markers corresponding to different geographic locations, it's much harder to get a decent idea of your genetic ancestry. But that's a whole other industry. There's a whole other set of direct-to-consumer companies that's all they do.
And those kind of industries, although they're very interesting, this is one of those conversations that we have about is how useful is personal genomics? And so for something like race, that may be important to people, but something like Alzheimer's, that may be far more important to people. Now, one of the things that I am concerned about is with organizations like 23andMe, although they are very specific, and I did read in your book that they do clarify what the risk level means. Understandably, people freak out if their results come back saying that they have the marker for something like Alzheimer's. I think we're talking about risk versus benefit here.
Yes. Again, I think this is in the eye of the beholder. This is really a function of one's frame of reference. So, you know, I spent many years in a genetics lab getting a PhD, studying human genetic disease, and being legally proscribed from interacting with the families I was studying. And the basis of that idea was that I would say something either wrong or inappropriate or, worst of all, something that would scare them or cause them anxiety.
Right.
And what George Church is saying is for those of us who are prepared to assume that risk. Why can't we see what is in our DNA? Now, back to Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's, it's kind of an outlier because Alzheimer's was what geneticists were hoping to find. That is, there is a gene that, if you have a certain version of it, raises your risk of developing late onset Alzheimer's disease. If you have one bad copy, then it raises your risk, say, threefold over average. If you have two bad copies, it raises your risk, say, 12-fold. So that can translate to a greater than 50% lifetime risk. So that's a powerful genetic marker. And geneticists were expecting to find many more powerful genetic markers that would predict and be shown to contribute to human disease. And they haven't. In the case of Alzheimer's, there's a guy at Harvard, used to be at Boston University, named Robert Greene, who in the late 90s said, what happens if we tell younger people whether or not they have this marker? And he was called a lot of names, and he was told that his career was going to be over, and that what he was doing was irresponsible. And to his enormous credit, he soldiered on. He set up a clinical trial, and he found out that, number one, people wanted to know, and number two, they rarely, if ever, regretted knowing, even if they got bad news. Now, about a year ago, there was a study in the New England Journal that was carried out by folks at Scripps that looked at 2,000 customers of Navigenics, and they found, in my opinion, two important things that maybe don't seem so surprising in retrospect. One is people don't freak out about this information, and they understand that with very rare exceptions, like Alzheimer's disease, the information has pretty weak predictive power. And the other thing is people don't really change their behavior. So they don't learn that they're at higher risk for type 2 diabetes and then suddenly run to the gym and change their diet and quit smoking. And why don't they do that? Well, because those things are hard. And genetic information is no more powerful at influencing people to change their behavior than any other sort of information. You know, change is hard.
We have a question from the chat room from Jim Carver.
Is there any reason to believe that a test, knowing the uncertainties, would be any more accurate than knowing traits of your own immediate family?
Well, it's funny you should say that. There was a couple of years ago, a scientist at Stanford had developed a new technique to sequence genomes. He sequenced his own genome, and he published it in Nature Biotechnology, and he made it public, just as members of the Personal Genome Project do, as participants do. And he was praised by the journal for being so brave. And somebody wrote in and, in my opinion, very wisely pointed out, why is this guy so brave when we could actually almost certainly make a better guess as to how he will die by simply asking him how his parents died,
right,
and his grandparents. So to answer the gentleman's question, it's not at all clear. As I mentioned, type 2 diabetes, it's now well studied. There are dozens of genetic markers that contribute to it. But, you know, it's not clear that knowing that stuff is more useful as a predictor than knowing, say, one's body mass index or waist to hip circumference, stuff like that that's quite easily measured.
And we'll be right back with more personal genomics with Misha Angrist, assistant professor at the Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Misha Angrist, assistant professor at the Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, and one of the first 10 people to have their genome sequenced as part of Harvard's Personal Genome Project. He's also the author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. Now, why would you personally, sir, want to have your entire genome sequenced?
Well, I can't say that, you know, it was a childhood dream. But, you know, as I said, I worked in a genetics lab for many years, and to look at one's own DNA or one's friends or family members, it was simply taboo. And I think after reading George Church and really contemplating this idea, there's kind of a, well, why not? And there was an overwhelming curiosity, I think. And it was a way, as I say in my book, you know, genetics had said, even to someone who had studied it, it was always an abstraction. And so here was a way to make it something else.
Well, just because you wanted to, even if you did want to, doesn't mean that you could. There were some rather significant barriers into being a participant in PGP in the first place.
First of all, simply logistically and financially, the PGP had always and continues to be kind of a shoestring operation because the National Institutes of Health was never comfortable with this idea of making genetic information public. And so the PGP has had to rely on private donors and foundations and that sort of thing. And, you know, this was a completely from the ground up operation. There were many delays, so much so that, you know, my publisher was threatening to cancel my book contract. And I said, well, I don't have a genome yet. And I went to my colleague, David Goldstein. He is a genomicist extraordinaire. And I made the case to him that I would be the ultimate control. He knew where I lived, and he was welcome to put me on a treadmill or an MRI or whatever he needed to do at any time. And he said, you should ask me this when I'm not sober. Which I think I did. And so he agreed. And so that was October of 2009. And he and Kevin Cheyenne, who is his colleague, who's a sequencing guru, they took my blood and sequenced my DNA. And it was only, I would say, a little less than a year ago that the PGP actually had the first 10 of us sequenced fully by a company in Silicon Valley called Complete Genomics.
I think what I'm really interested in is this informed consent process, because there are very few of you who could actually fall into that category of informed.
Right. Although the reality is that that is not nearly as true as it was. So for the 10 of us initially, the Harvard Institutional Review Board that oversees research with human beings wanted us all to have a master's in genetics or better. That was not George's idea. That was the IRB's idea. And that's just, number one, not practical, and two, a pretty elitist way to do science. So what the PGP came up with was a way to have informed consent that was actually meaningful, in my opinion. So I actually serve on the Duke IRB, and every month I wade through these consent forms that are 20 pages long, and you know, I wouldn't read them. I mean, I might read them out of some perverse academic curiosity, but they're full of legalese and all kinds of crazy stuff, which is not to say that the PGP consent form is shorter, but in order to even get to that point, you have to pass an exam, and you have to score 100% on the exam. And the exam contains questions not only about genetics, but about what would you do if you learned that you were at high risk of developing a genetic disease. And if you say, I would go outside and put a gun in my mouth, you're probably not a good candidate for the PGP. You can take the exam multiple times. It's sort of like the driver's test. And so what it does is it winds up attracting people who really want to be participants, right, and really understand what's at stake. And so I think at last count, something like 1,500 people had been enrolled. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't have predicted that based on what I knew, say, 2 years ago. So it's really a credit to the people in Boston who have really just made this thing out of duct tape and mirrors.
Well, let's talk about the privacy aspect of this. Now, you had to consent to put almost your entire personal genome online. You were allowed to redact certain things. But there are inherent dangers in that, are there not? Or at least troublesome aspects.
Well, so we were talking about Alzheimer's before. So one can imagine an insurance company looking at a genome that is freely available online and saying, you know what, this guy's got two copies of APOE4. He's at high risk of developing Alzheimer's sometime in the next 20 or 30 years. So we don't want anything to do with him. And for, say, a long-term care insurer in the U.S., that sort of behavior would be perfectly legal. Because our protections against genetic discrimination apply only to healthcare and to employment. And even there, there are a lot of holes. So that is certainly a risk. But, you know, the thing I always point out is, so far, the insurance industry has shown very little interest in genetics. And I actually say this in the book, that when I told my primary care doc that I was going to get my genome sequenced and make it public, you know, do you have any advice for me as a physician? You know, I expected her to say, I think you should see a psychiatrist. In fact, what she said was, I think you should load up on life insurance and long-term care insurance. The point I'm trying to make is that asymmetry of information cuts both ways. You know, the fact that I know that I'm not at higher risk for Alzheimer's based on that particular genotype, maybe I don't want to invest as much in long-term care insurance. Maybe somebody who is at higher risk is going to get insured out the wazoo, and chances are the long-term care insurer is not going to ask, what is your APOE genotype? Maybe that will change. We'll see.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Misha Angrist, the author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. We've talked sort of, or at least I've asked questions about a lot of the negative aspects of this process, but there are many, many positives to knowing your genes, let's say. So genetically appropriate treatments, we talked about warfarin, so dosing based on genotype. But one of the issues that I guess I'm concerned about is the fact that what with the newness of all this, if you take your personal genomics results to your doctor, they're probably going to have very little idea of what to do with them, I would assume. Are there many GPs that are actively trying to integrate DNA into care plans? I can't think of any. I know mine wouldn't.
I probably know them all, and you could count them on two hands. Maybe that's wrong, and that's probably a glib and cynical answer, because I think their numbers are growing. In the paperback version of my book, I have an updated epilogue, and I talk about this little boy in Wisconsin who had terrible GI problems and could not put on weight and had 100 surgeries before his second birthday. And his medical team was just flummoxed and had run out of ideas. And they finally said, can we sequence his genome or his exome, the protein coding parts? And after a lot of consternation and anxious meetings and trying to find a way to pay for it, which third-party insurance ultimately did. So they did that, and they found a mutation, and they gave him a cord blood transplant, a stem cell transplant, and he is doing, by all accounts, last I've heard, he is doing quite well. And I think he was on the Today Show. He was on an American morning show, I want to say last Christmas, and seemed to be full of life. And so that story really captured people's imagination and has many academic medical centers, including the one I work at, scrambling to sort of clone this model of finding people who have been on diagnostic odysseys who are likely to have a genetic problem that's not been identified, and sequencing their DNA and trying to find at least a cause for their problems, and in the best of all worlds, to use that information to guide their care to something more effective. Now, I would say these are still early days, and there are still a lot of unanswered questions about not only the science, but all of the other things we've talked about, the informed consent, and what do you do with the rest of that information? So let's say you find a mutation, you find a variant that is present in the patient and not present in controls, and you're pretty sure it contributes to the disease. But meanwhile, you have all of this other information about what other, say, recessive diseases that the patient carries, his or her drug response, and then some of the frivolous things that companies like 23andMe give back. You know, do I have a genetic variant that makes my pee smell funny after I eat asparagus?
Is there actually a gene for that?
Indeed, there
that
is.
That is brilliant.
To me, that sort of exemplifies the range of the information that one can get. And you can say, well, that's frivolous, that's stupid, that's pointless. I would say, isn't that interesting? Isn't that funny? Isn't that fun? Isn't that a way to engage people in genetics and genomics and science? And all of these things that, as a society, we profess that we want to educate our children to be part of, some of the American resistance to that notwithstanding.
That's a whole show right there, sir.
Yeah.
We actually have a bunch of audience questions. We'll get to some of these from Kylie via Twitter.
Is copywriting genomes feasible?
To the best of my knowledge, no. We know that patenting genes, individual genes, is possible. And actually, there is a company in Australia that managed to get a patent on junk DNA. A while ago, I was saying we don't know what most of human DNA does. Is it just sort of an evolutionary toolkit or an evolutionary hangover? And this company, these evil geniuses in Australia, managed to get a patent on most of the DNA in the human genome because of its lack of utility, of all things, you know, the exact opposite of what we typically associate with patentable subject matter. And not only that, they then went around and shook down mostly genetic diagnostic companies and said, you owe us because you are sequencing some of the DNA or genotyping some of the DNA to which we hold a patent. And there's been an ongoing court case in the U.S., a company called Myriad Genetics that has patents on the BRCA1 and 2 genes that predispose to hereditary breast cancer and is a, I don't know, $100 million a year business here. And the American Civil Liberties Union and a group of pathologists took them to court a couple of years ago and said, you know, you can't do this. And the lower court judge said, that's right, you can't. DNA is not patentable. His ruling was largely but not completely overturned by a higher court. And both sides are actually now appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we ought to see some definitive rule, I would hope, in the next couple of years.
And we have a question from the chat from Chuck.
How does consumer access to personal genomic information differ, in your opinion, from access to medical test information currently under the purview of a physician, like a cholesterol test?
That's an excellent question. So a physician would say, and many geneticists would say, well, the thing about a cholesterol test is it has clear and obvious meaning. Meaning, if you have high cholesterol, you know you're at higher risk of developing heart disease or diabetes or other health problems. If you have a twofold risk of some rare genetic disease, so that instead of your risk being, you know, 1 in 20,000, it's 2 in 20,000, what have you really learned? So I think that's fair. And this gets back to the meaningless versus dangerous argument. And that is simply for the meaningless stuff, I think it's hard to make an argument that a physician should be involved. And for the dangerous stuff, and again, I'm using quotes around that word, I think that is up to the individual. And, you know, if you think about cancer in the 1960s, most oncologists would not tell their patients that they had cancer. And today that's unthinkable. And, you know, I've been in plenty of meetings where people are standing on their heads and contorting themselves in various ways to get someone's entire genome or entire exome and, you know, not give them back any of that information. They simply want to just chuck it in the rubbish bin. And I would say that's cowardly and irresponsible.
We have a question from Mary, and this will be the last audience question.
I'm seeing more and more DNA deniers, much like vaccination deniers, and DNA conspiracy theorists. Some of this could undermine public health uses of genomics, similarly to the way the anti-vaxxers have undermined public health. So I'm wondering how we can get out in front of some of this, or what your opinion is on what to do with the inevitable anti-science blogs, tweets, and news sites about these things.
Well, that's an excellent question and a very legitimate one. And I don't feel like DNA denial is in the same sort of crisis place where, say, vaccine denial is. So my friend Seth Mnookin has written this wonderful book called The Panic Virus about the vaccine denial trend, I guess. But I think, you know, in the case of DNA, so the question makes me think of this woman in Texas who complained because her child's DNA and lots of newborn screening samples were being used for research without consent. Now, presumably they were de-identified, so there was not a way to track a particular sample to a person. And I understand the outrage and it is outrageous. And I think one of the ways to combat that sort of paranoia, even if it's legitimate, is to say, why should we, referring to the previous question, why should we be more freaked out about DNA than we are about cholesterol? Or that story I told earlier, why should we attribute more significance to genomic information than we do to what killed one's parents or one's waist circumference? This is the cultural legacy of the eugenics movement of the 20th century, of a lot of really fascinating pop culture and science fiction movies. But I think, you know, what we've learned over the last few years is the story is a lot more subtle and complicated. And to be a genetic determinist in 2012 is simply
and with that,
impossible to do.
Misha, thanks in very good much conscience. For being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
You can find links to Misha Angrist in his book, Here is a Human Being, at the Dawn of Personal Genomics, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk to geriatrician Dr. Thomas Pearls about his work on the Archon Genomics X Prize after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're teaming up with Scientific American magazine to bring you part one of a two-part series on the technologies profiled in their World-Changing Ideas feature article. We'll talk to Scientific American editors and writers and researchers who are developing cutting-edge tech that just might shape the future of our society and our planet. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here with Dr. Tom Pearls, geriatrician at Boston Medical Center, associate professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, and a fellow of the American College of Physicians. In 1995, during his training as a geriatrician at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Pearls founded the New England Centenarian Study, which since then has grown to be the largest study of centenarians in the world. He's also the author of Living to 100. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Tom.
Thanks very much.
Now tell us about the Archon Genomics X Prize.
Well, the X Prize, people may have heard about before, they offer prizes to accelerate a particular technology faster and cheaper and better than it would otherwise without a competition. And, you know, it kind of harkens back to the competition to foster air travel. So there was a competition to see who could get across the Atlantic first. And of course, we all know Lindbergh did that.
Right.
There was, I think, a $25,000 prize for that, which in today's dollars is something like $5 million or something crazy like that. And not so crazy because I think the amount for this particular prize is $10 million. Most recently, people may remember the competition to get a reusable spacecraft up into space, bring it back down, and launch it again within a week. That was one, and I think that's since turned in, the rights for that spacecraft has turned into something called Virgin Galactic. So this particular prize is a recognition that while whole genome sequencing has happened, that is, all 6 billion nucleotides of the whole genome have somehow been quantified or decoded, not really, because it's still very inaccurate. Lots of errors are generally made. And it's also still very, very expensive. We just had it done on a couple of super centenarians, people who lived to 110 or older. And at the time, that cost us about $45,000 a piece. I think now you can get it down to about $8,000 a piece. But it's still nowhere near accurate enough. And what we mean by accurate enough would be medical grade. That is something that doctors in the future would actually depend upon in terms of making reasonable medical decisions based upon whole genome sequences. The other is that it takes a while and that it's still pretty expensive. So the prize is for any company out there that could whole genome sequence 100 people in 30 days at the cost of less than $1,000 a person, and to do so with less than one error per million bases. And the group that wins that competition will get $10 million.
This is intense, sir.
It's interesting and very exciting. And it's exciting to me because they had to come up with what 100 subjects they're going to do the whole genome sequencing on. And another doctor who does centenarian studies named Nir Barzilai at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I convinced them that a great bunch of people to do whole genome sequencing on would be centenarians, not just people who live to 100, but really old people, maybe 105 and older. And the reason that we pushed this was our recognition that these individuals get to their extreme old ages because of a pretty significant genetic component, as opposed to just being environmental or behavioral. So that if we did some sequencing, we'd hope to find some important genes associated with the trait. But also, medical genomics hasn't really done such a hot job in translating their findings into medical therapies because they've been looking at disease-associated variants. And there hasn't been much to come out of that. On the other hand, we think with these centenarians, they actually have just as many disease-associated variants as the general population. But what makes them different is the presence of longevity-associated variants, variants that might actually be protective, variants that might trump or cancel out variations that could be bad for you,
right,
and may slow down the rate of aging and decrease your risk for age-related diseases. And if we knew what those were, and we have an idea of a few of them, maybe that could translate into some proactive therapies and proactive screening to prevent things from happening so soon in our hopefully rather long lives.
Well, where are you finding all of these centenarians?
I have a very special whistle. No. Well, I've been doing this with research assistants since 1995. We have in the New England Centenarian Study now about 2,000 centenarians. We have the largest collection of supercentenarians in the world, at about 115 of them now. They're very, very rare. They're about 1 per 5 million in the population, the 110-year-olds and older. And really, I think the best source for that these days has been the internet, with people in the media doing stories on these folks. And then it's relatively easy for us to contact them once we see a story about them. And the other source is that their families will contact us on our website, and we can then talk to them about the studies and enroll them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Tom Perls about the Archon Genomics XPRIZE. So you said that you're looking for a medical-grade genome. So how exactly will they go about finding that?
Well, they have to come up with the technology and to be incentivized by the competition and the prize to do that. Over the next year or so, hopefully the various competitors will be working like crazy with their various technologies to get to less than one error per million in these genomes, which translates into about a 98% or greater accuracy. And it's kind of like building the airplane to cross the Atlantic. One needs to get the technology to fulfill the ability to do those 3,000 miles over open water, and to do it cheaply and to do it quickly.
Will this be the first medical-grade genome?
I'm not aware of any such genome to date. We actually had Craig Venter as one of the speakers at one of the press conferences announcing the enrollment of centenarians for the prize, and he said that we're nowhere near accurate enough to depend upon these sequences for assessing one's risk or propensity for various genetic-related or associated traits. So, no, I don't think that exists as of yet, and that's in part what this prize is about trying to get to.
Well, why don't we have one yet? What are the obstacles?
Well, now you're not speaking to the person in the lab who does this for a living in terms of the actual whole genome sequencing, but right. I mean, you're talking an awful lot of data. I mean, terabytes of data and 3 billion base pairs of information. And you can imagine the errors that can come about when dealing with that amount of data. And so as of yet, the fidelity doesn't exist, and they have to get there.
Well, not that I don't love the competitive aspect of this, because I do, but I assume there are also good scientific reasons to have a bunch of researchers working separately on the genes of the same 100 people, correct?
Well, that's true. One of the stipulations that I and Dr. Barzilai made in terms of our willingness to find subjects to enroll for the competition was that all their data had to eventually become publicly available to qualified researchers, and the data will be posted on a service called dbGaP at the National Institute of Health. And what I mean by qualified researchers is that they need to have their own institutional review board approved protocol to analyze and report upon the analysis and publications. And this helps protect the subjects, because that's what IRB approval is about, is making sure that subjects are well protected. They also have to agree that they're not going to make any attempt to identify who the subjects are. So we try to keep the data as de-identified as possible, though some would argue that the genetic information itself identifies the subject. But they have to promise not to try and identify the subject. And we're hoping not to just post the winning sequence, but actually data from all the competitors, and then you have a huge amount of redundancy from which investigators will have access, and you know they may have their own platforms that they're using, and some of the data that are generated will come from platforms that they are using, so it could be quite valuable for the various different investigators with different genotyping or sequencing platforms that are available to people today.
So do you think that science gets done better or faster when you sort of wave the carrot being scads of cash?
You know, for some companies, I think that $10 million is small change, as amazingly as that may sound, but bragging rights are pretty important.
Right.
And, you know, we see it all the time. It amazes me that when I'm about to come out with a research article, that somebody else, after all these years, is just about to do the same too. And this, so scientists are used to this competition all the time. And it does get things moving faster. And it gets a exchange of ideas happening faster. On the one hand, some people may disdain the competition. And on the other hand, it really does keep things moving along.
It also gets a lot of media attention on a piece of research that is spectacularly valuable.
Well, it is spectacularly valuable. I think that the Archon Prize already is doing quite an interesting service in terms of trying to educate the public about the value of genetic research and how it will potentially help people in the future. And also, one of the reasons I'm involved is that they're also trying to do a good job of educating people about the wonders and benefits of studying the extreme old, and how that may pay off in the future. So there's definitely a promotion and education effort to this right now without any particular findings, but more just discussing the potential benefits of what's about to happen. Certainly people like Francis Collins, who's now the director of the NIH, but as many people know, one of the folks that was instrumental in the first whole genome sequencing, along with Craig Venter. And he feels very strongly that looking for genetic determinants of disease and health is the wave of the future.
Well, I love this. And thanks very much for being here, Tom.
My pleasure.
You can find the link to the Archon Genomics X Prize on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also click the links to our Twitter feed, our Facebook page, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.